Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the 4th of March, and it's Magga Puja. Magga Puja is a celebration which is observed very strongly in Thailand, in Southeast Asia, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, and Burma. Not so much in Sri Lanka. And it's one of the big Buddhist celebrations in Southeast Asia. And it commemorates an occasion in the life of the Buddha where 1,250 enlightened monastics came together unannounced, spontaneously, to hear the Buddhist teachings. And it was the occasion where the Buddha offered what we call the Ovadha-patimokkha, the kind of briefest recitation of the teaching: do good, refrain from doing harm, and purify the heart. This is the most direct statement of the teaching that we often hear. So today we're going to, for those of you can bear the wind and the cold, we're going to do a circumambulation after the talk. And Yom Yu and friends have prepared candles, incense, and flowers there. And we'll start at the Buddha Rupa, and then we'll walk around the property to the Bhikkhu Vihara, up to the road, and around three times. And Nathan has started a fire, so we're all set for an evening of devotion and reflection. And I see that our devas have brought flowers. This is gorgeous. There's a double here, small one, big one. And this is one of the things in a day of celebration, or any day, we often try to decorate the shrine, to bring flowers, candles, incense, as a way of a physical way of expressing our love of the teaching. And the way I've learned it is that flowers represent moral purity, sila. So a human being who lives a moral life has the beauty of a blooming flower. And then the candles represent wisdom, panya, light which dispels darkness, and the incense represents samadhi, or cultivation of a focused and settled mind. Sila, samadhi, panya is another brief way that we sometimes talk about the teaching. And these are the symbols that Theravada uses, but it's quite a lovely thing to prepare a bouquet of flowers, and then to, and one doesn't, you don't need to ask, you can just go and get some vases in the kitchen, and get some flowers, and bring them, offer them to the shrine. It's a lovely devotional act, and it certainly is nice for us in the community. Much appreciated. So this day, Magga Puja, the days of celebration that we have in the Buddhist calendar are very stylized and very almost mythical in their descriptions, but I kind of reflect myself what might have happened at that time in the life of the Buddha. So we kind of speculate that it was very early in his teaching career, and it was in February. So the way the monastic community functioned in India is that during the rainy season, the monsoon in India, it's very, very difficult to move around, very muddy, and flooded streams and such like. So the monks were, all the ascetics that existed, were very much more stable during the monsoon season. So they stayed in one place, in religious parks or in caves or wherever. And through the course of the life of the Buddha, that sense of settledness became a disciplinary necessity, where monks have to stay for 3 months in the what they call the rains retreat. That came a bit later, we think, in the life of the Sangha. But if the monks had been stable and stationary for the monsoon season, then they would have, after that, probably got their gear together and started to wander. And if they were wandering, movement would have been pretty slow. So you can imagine it would have taken some time to reach the Buddha if they were scattered over that area of India. And so it kind of makes sense this season, a good season for walking, it's cooler, that they might have reached Rajagaha, Jetavana, where the Buddha was living, and offered their homage to him and sought teaching from him. And at that time, there were also many other ascetics and teachers, and the Jain religion was, we think, that Jain monasticism was quite strong at that time. So there was a lot going on in the religious world, in the religious spiritual realm in India at that time. And also we have in the early texts the Buddha converting large numbers of ascetics. And even we have Vinaya rule, where the Buddha returned to his home territory and his own clan of people. The young men were so inspired, they took up the robe to such an extent that the families were losing all their young men. And a rule then, and they would go, and they went to the Buddha and complained about this. So the Buddha said, okay, from now on, if anyone wants to ordain, no matter what age, they need, if the parents are alive, they need full consent from both parents. And so that rule came about. So there must have been a tremendous, obviously they're a charismatic man, and his teaching must have really galvanized so many, many, many people. Also, you read in the text where lay people are saying other sects, quite often a person who has lived family life would become a sannyasin and take up the life of asceticism or the life of renunciation, which is a good thing. But what they were impressed with was how many young men had joined the order. So the Sangha, it seems to have kind of really taken off very quickly. I kind of think of when we started Chithurst in 1979. Once there was a place, and Ajahn Sumedho had a kind of venue for teaching, that the Sangha grew triple-fold. I mean, it grew from small numbers, so triple doesn't mean that much, I guess. If you do the math, it wasn't that great. But still, we went from about 4 to 20 in 2 years. So all of a sudden, maybe more, I can't remember. But all of a sudden, many, many more people. So that's the way I kind of ponder, what was going on at that time. And so you can imagine, like, this mass of monks who are grateful to the Buddha and going after the rains retreat, going and seeking teaching from him. The way we celebrate these days in Thailand, I guess in Sri Lanka and other Buddhist countries, is to do circumambulation. And that's a very traditional devotional practice. If you go on pilgrimage to India, you do that. And the tradition or the etiquette around that is usually you keep your right shoulder to the main shrine, so you end up going clockwise around the main shrine, whatever the main shrine is. So if you go to Bodh Gaya, you go to the large temple there, where the Bodhi tree is, and then you go around, people are circumambulating. And one of the things we do in Theravada is we chant Itipiso, which we've been learning on the Triple Gem. So there's a kind of formal recitation that we do, and then the circumambulation, and we use candles, incense, and flowers, that symbology, and go around the shrine 3 times. Some people will just do it many, 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 many times. So there are these devotional practices in Theravada, which are very uplifting, very uplifting. So if you ever have a chance to go on pilgrimage, you can you get a whole, and like going to Bodh Gaya, say, it's a rather marvelous experience to go to Bodh Gaya, because this is where the Buddha attained enlightenment. And what you find is multicultural Buddhism. So you have Japanese and Sri Lankan and Thais and Burmese and Tibetans and Chinese and Westerners of all types. And they're all doing their devotions in their own particular tradition. So some are, like if you get the Nichiren, they're chanting Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, or if you get the Sri Lankan groups, they usually put flowers all around the main shrine. And then the Theravada chanting Itipiso, and some people are meditating, and you have a group of Tibetans up back doing full-length prostrations, and people chanting in Chinese, and it's really rather wonderful, because it's totally chaotic, disorganized, filled with devotion, and very friendly, because everyone respects everyone else. Oh, you do it this way. Oh, I do it this way. Great, you do it your way. And so there's no kind of conflict there of different ways of expressing devotion, because the devotion is common. Everyone is grateful for the teaching and grateful for the opportunity to be at the place of enlightenment and express their gratitude and devotion. It's a marvelous, marvelous experience. To be there and feel that. So we have our own take on this. So in the West, we've named this day Sangha Day. I don't think they call that Sangha Day in Thailand. They just call it Magga Puja. Sangha Day. So we have Sangha Day, Buddha Day, and Dharma Day. So Buddha Day is the full moon of Vaisakh, which is usually May, but this year it will be in beginning of June. And then Asala Puja, which is full moon of July, which is the first teaching. Asala Puja, Magga Puja, and Vaisakh, Vaisakha Puja. And these are the 3 days that are very big in a Buddhist calendar in Theravada Buddhism. And the kind of devotional side of Buddhism in the West comes kind of slowly. Mostly people enter it from having done a retreat or from psychology and so on. But to be able to have a form, to have imagery, to have icons, to have art, to have chanting, to have body language like bowing and anjali, all these are new to Westerners. But I know for myself, just to have that ways of a cultural expression is, to me, is a great gift from Asia, a great gift that we have not just a group of meditators, but we have a cultural format. And the word Sangha is much, it's used very commonly now in the West, but in traditional cultures, Sangha always referred to the ordained Sangha. Sometimes the Arya Sangha, those who have attained one of the levels of realization, or the 4 levels of realization, or sometimes just the ordained, those who have gone forth, as we say. And the word now in use, it's like my Sangha, can be just a sitting group. So it's rather lost its power. It's rather lost its power, I think, unfortunately, because I once asked someone in a sitting group where they call themselves Sangha, I said, so if someone drinks alcohol, do you call them on it? Do they keep 5 precepts? And I said, if someone commits adultery, can your Sangha say to the person that's against the precepts? And what I found is everyone prevaricated. No one was going to call anyone else out on observation of precepts. No, we're just a sitting group. And that, to me, weakens the word Sangha. Weakens the word, because Sangha does imply commitment. So I know in Toronto I was saying this to people. So I would say, well, if you're going to use the word, try to give it some weight. Give it some weight and say, okay, if I'm going to call myself a member of the Sangha, I'm going to keep some precepts, 5 precepts at least. make some kind of commitment, some kind of renunciation, some kind of determination to realize Nibbana. Otherwise, it becomes a word which is just very, more like a coffee group that sits together and meditates. Loses, I think. It's a good word. It's a good word, but it'd be a shame if it lost its vitality. And that's a conflict sometimes between Western meditators and Asian meditators. Some of our friends in Ottawa from the Asian Buddhist communities, they find it very difficult when Sangha is used in a kind of more amorphous way, I suppose. But that's culture, words change. But the idea of Sangha is that there is a deep, deep determination to realize Nibbana. This is how, when we ordain as bhikkhus or bhikkhunis or seminaries, our ordination chanting has in it to take up this training for the realization of Nibbana. So there's a kind of transcendent impetus to one's ordination. And then the commitment to a strong body of renunciant rules, a commitment to a communal way of living together. These are strong things for the practice. And not everyone is suited to that, and not everyone should be a monastic. It would be right. Actually, very few are suited to this vocation. But I think everyone has a bit of the monastic in them. I mean, everyone has a kind of reflective capacity. And the idea of the ordained Sangha is that the ordained Sangha, through wearing the robe, hopefully creates an icon in society, an image in society that there are spiritual values, that there is a spiritual dimension to life, that there is something to aspire for bigger than a consumer product or just comfort and entertainment. And in secular society, we have very, very few indications of that. So when we were in London, Ajahn Chah would say, we just walk around, alms round, and wear your robe, it's your flag, and see what happens. And there was a scholar, an Asian scholar on Buddhism, and he was a monastic, and he wrote that when monastics are in the West, they should not wear their robes on the street. They should wear a brown suit. It has to be brown, I guess. Drive a car and have money, and then when they go into their temple, then they could put the robes on. And we read that, and we said, well, if we have to do that, we're going back to Thailand. No way. So we said, we'll just try this, let's see if it works. And it was a kind of curious thing to do, because it's very foreign. And it's not so foreign to England, because England does have a monastic tradition. It's much more foreign in a place like New Zealand. Somewhat foreign here too, although there's a Christian monastic tradition. But when Lompo Samedo went to Ajahn Chah, when he was going to come to England, and he went to Ajahn Chah and said, is this going to really work? You know, is monasticism really going to work in England? And Lompo Samedo said, well, are there generous people? He said, yes, of course. Well, it'll work. Just make a good soup and they'll come. And so it worked out. It worked out very well. But what was interesting for me in all of that was that we pretty much decided that if we couldn't live as bhikkhus from that kind of forced tradition of Vinaya, we would just go back to Asia. We weren't going to compromise the Vinaya for the sake of a modern cultural format. And of course, it's very tempting to do that. And there's a lot of people who say, well, you know, you have to adapt. But we decided, well, yeah, we have to adapt. We have to have different clothing and so on and so forth. But there are certain principles we were not going to give up. And I think that has proven to be very, very fruitful. Worked out very, very well. So here we are in Perth, somehow surviving. The strength of a tradition is it comes that if a tradition is well used, certainly monasticism has lots of problems, and there's corruption, like in any country, like where the church has so much power. Thailand is certainly lots of problems, undeniable. But the idea of a vehicle like Theravada Buddhism is that it has references which are not just personal. It's not like based on a guru. So even Lhat Mon Pacha, he wasn't a guru. He didn't point to himself. He always was a very, very observed Vinaya. He was very understanding of his own culture. He worked within his own culture. He led his culture in terms of Dhamma, and he was never above the Vinaya. Never. No monk can be above the Vinaya. No monk can say, "Well, I'm enlightened, so I can drink whiskey or whatever." Can't do that. And so the references to the Dhamma and to the Vinaya are very impersonal. They're not invented by one person. And that's very healthy, where all of us, monastics and lay people, can say, well, what is the convention that we live by? So like if the Vinaya is available to lay people, it's not an esoteric, private, secret kind of teaching. So if a monk is doing something which is inappropriate, lay people can call him on it. They say, hey, wait a minute. You know, we're feeding you because we expect a certain standard of living and practice. And so everyone is actually protected if lived well. Senior monks, like when monks become teachers, they have the defilements of being a teacher come up. That's what we say. We say the defilements of fame only come up when fame comes into your life. And so teachers who become well-known or popular, or they're very much praised and they have a lot of resources coming at them, a lot of wealth, which is very tricky to handle. And we've had difficulties where monks have gotten alienated from their own sangha, from their own peers, and just gone off and been very popular with lay people, and then do something foolish, disrobe, and not that disrobing is necessarily foolish, but disrobe from a foolish place of hubris and conceit, because they've lost the humility and perspective of being a member of a sangha. And whereas the way it really works is that everyone in our monastic order, we have a duty actually, that if a monk, no matter how junior or senior is, if a monk is going against the training rules, other monks have to say, "Bhante," or "Venerable, that's not appropriate. That's not to our standards." And so everyone is actually protected. And so senior monks who get a lot of attention from laity, or again, who get a lot of resources, if they return to the life of a monastic with their own peers, with junior monks, just a normal life, then they always have the reflection of monks who are living by a certain standard. And we call that samana sanya, the perception of a samana. And a samana is one who has basically turned away from the five khandhas, turned away from the fascination with sense experience, and is now seeking transcendent. And samana sanya for us is like the robe, simplicity of living, certain standards of speech, all the renunciant practices we do, and that is very, very, very powerful. So today we had our Patimokkha recitation, where we recited the rules, and it's a very ritualized format. And Venerable Chunda chanted, it took him about 45 minutes, all the rules. And then the two samaneras came in and they chanted their recitation. So it's very kind of formal and structured, but it's interesting how it always reminds one, oh, yeah, this is our life. This is our life together as a community, as a renunciant community. Our aspiration is Nibbana. We have responsibilities. And that's very, very helpful, very powerful, because it always just puts you back in line. Samana Sanya, I'm a samana. These are my values. Content with little, being content with alms food and four requisites. And so hopefully the way it works then for the lay people also is that you have a body of practitioners who, in this case here, male community, who have a standard that is not, it's not based on popular culture. It's not based on the fads of popular culture. It's not based on the economic ups and downs of culture. It's not based on fashionable psychological trends. It's not based on, all manner of things that go through society. And I've seen that over the years as a monk, that certainly there are fads which hit monasteries, different, like, especially psychological fads and healing fads and fasting fads, and all these different ideas go through a monastery. But always the stability is Four Noble Truths, aspiration to Nibbana, renunciation. So there's a kind of weight and stability of tradition, which doesn't have to be the weight is actually very helpful, because sometimes we think tradition, the weight of tradition is unimaginative or stultified or lost in old conservative ways. But when it's done well, then you have the ideas of orthodoxy and orthopraxy. Orthodoxy is a certain doctrine of a certain body of teaching which is handed down. Orthopraxy, in the kind of spiritual way of thinking about that, orthopraxy is using that body of teaching to realize a transcendent. That's what it's about. And when you don't have an intellectual rigor, when you don't have a body of knowledge which is agreed upon, the intellect is just playing around with ideas, and when you don't hold a set of ideas which should actually work, then the intellect gets lost into speculative things and so on. But if that body of knowledge that you have is then simply believed in and respected, and the whole thing becomes just an intellectual regurgitation of ideas passed down, then it's also dead, and that's scholasticism. But if the body of knowledge is then used for reflection, for personal reflection, and then practiced for the sake of Nibbana, for the sake of transcendence, then you have orthodoxy and orthopraxy, and that's what makes orthodoxy very much alive and vital. And so that's the way of Theravada, is to take the really basic structures of Buddhist teaching, especially the forest tradition, take the Four Noble Truths, stick with those, look at other things, sure, but stick with those, that's the basis. Three characteristics, dependent origination, so these fundamental teachings, and then go deeply. Take your own life, take your own suffering, take your own predicament, and go deeply into those and see, what's the freedom? How can I gain freedom? And that's a very powerful, it's a powerful, powerful tool if used in that way. And the forest tradition in Thailand is particularly, I really love it, obviously, because I stuck with it, but I love it because it allows for expression of individuality through the orthodoxy. So the orthodoxy of the teaching, like Four Noble Truths, is a kind of structure that we're all required to learn, and the different teachings, and then as we apply those basic principles, why do I suffer? What's the cause? What's the end of suffering? What's the path? Through that inner questioning, each monastic has, and each layperson, has their own take on it, has their own insight. And then when they get the chance to share that or teach that, they express it through their own example, through their own struggle, and so on. So there's this interesting constant vitality in life in a teaching which is actually the same since 2,560, 58 years since the Buddha passed away, we think. And so somebody like Ajahn Sumedho, I find very inspiring, because he's taken the Four Noble Truths and just become more and more profound in his expression of it. And you think, 50 years as a monk, you need to want variety. But the thing about variety is sometimes you get breadth, but you don't get depth. Whereas if you take something fundamental to the teaching of the Buddha and you just keep reflecting on it profoundly, you go very deep. So knowledge can have breadth, but it can then be very, it can still be a kind of intellectual conceit, almost, or intellectual comfort. I know a lot. It doesn't mean the person's liberated from suffering. To find someone who has an encyclopedic mind, but also has gone deeply, deeply into the basic teaching, that is a rarity. That is wonderful. Someone like Lompa Puttata was a great scholar, but also went deeply into that. So that you find was very, very inspiring. So the first tradition emphasizes more the depth rather than the breadth, whereas scholastic tradition emphasizes the breadth. Scholars have a very important place in Buddhism. And not that there aren't scholars in the forest tradition that exists too. So in your own practice, just kind of consider what is your, like, in terms of what is your aspiration? What is your aspiration? How does it fit with the ideas of samana sanya, of renunciation? How can you live those things as a layperson? How can you do that skillfully? The danger in Theravada Buddhism is that the monks are always just pointing to themselves and saying, you know, this is what you have to do, but that can't be, because not everyone is really meant to take this vocation. Not everyone should take it, but I think everyone has a bit of the monastic in them. So I'll leave that there for consideration.
Andamayam dhamma kataya sarukaram dadamase.